You may have noticed recently that the truth is now a matter for debate.
Well, as you know, 2018 brought its share of fake news.
Fake news is the worst thing that you can call a journalist.
This is fake news.
I hate the term fake news. I don't really know where it's come from.
It's all fake news.
I mean, let's just call it lies.
In a time when opinion, bias, reporting, and anecdotes are increasingly mistaken for one another, at least in enough people's mind to make determining what's true difficult, facts have never been more important. When everything else is in question, you go to the data, unless it's just not there. You would be amazed to learn just how many things Canada doesn't keep track of, or if it does, doesn't make available to the people who need the information. If a country's data set is a solar system of interconnected numbers and figures collected from around the population, then Canada's is riddled with black holes. And what happens when you can't answer questions with data? Never heard of the phrase flying blind? This is what happens when a country tries to do it. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. The Globe and Mail has spent the past year investigating a phenomenon it calls the data deficit. Joining us today are reporters Eric Andrew G.
Hi.
And Tavia Grant.
Hello.
Who is Arjuman Siddiqui, and how does the story kind of start with her?
Yeah, so Arjuman is a public health researcher at U of T. I was thinking about writing an editorial about this phenomenon I had noticed more than a year ago now that reporters like Tavia, actually, and Robin Doolittle and other people in our newsroom were doing the job of StatsCan over and over, writing stories about how we didn't have numbers and then going out and finding numbers about what's the most dangerous job in Canada or how often police determine that sexual assault complaints are unfounded, this kind of thing. And I'm still kind of on the editorial board, kind of filling in for someone, writing the Globe's opinion about X, Y, and Z. I was just going to kind of mouth off about this and say this is really dumb and frustrating and write 700 words and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I emailed some colleagues in the newsroom. One of them put me onto Arjuman and said, this drives her crazy all the time. So I called her up. She works on race and health, figuring out racial disparities in health. And that's really hard in Canada. And that drives her up the wall. So I could tell immediately when I started talking to her that this was going to be a cathartic interview for her. She started kind of spilling her guts. This is the bane of my existence. You know, I end up writing about the U.S., about how African-American mothers have, you know, worse maternal health, or how black people in the U.S. have worse heart health. And a lot of that stuff's really hard to get at in Canada. And she's Canadian. I mean, she wants to be writing about her country and helping put these issues on the radar of policymakers and so they can target health supports at the right people, et cetera. And either we don't collect the numbers on race because as a country we're pretty squeamish about race and we tend not to gather data by race, or the numbers are there but they're holed up in these kind of bunkers that called the research data centers that StatsCan runs to ostensibly to help researchers get access to data, but effectively often preventing them from doing so by making them jump through all these bureaucratic hurdles, get fingerprinted, give up their passport.
Get data from StatsCan?
It's to avoid breaching confidentiality when you're looking at this data, sometimes based on the employment and, let's say, the immigration status of a dentist in Moose Jaw. You could figure out who this person was if you're
right.
But, you know, this is something that other countries have grappled with in ways that allow them to make much more data public. So StatsCan is unusually restrictive in this way.
So give me a sense of the scope of this problem. Do we have any idea how far this goes and how much there is out there that we're not collecting?
I don't know if we have data to measure our lack of data.
Yeah.
and I tried to do some cross-country comparisons. We do know a few things. We knew that the problem was severe from our reporting because reporters look often across sectors and we're often sort of on the front lines of trying to figure out how to tell a story and what evidence there is that we can then add anecdotes and real people to. Once we started looking and talking to people, the scale of the problem was much bigger than personally I had ever imagined, even though I have been writing about data gaps for probably 10 years. And even since publishing this story, we had an online tool in which we had 28 data gaps identified. And those were things that we could conclusively show that either there's just no data or it's totally inaccessible. So that's how we defined it, basically.
What kinds of things are those?
Some of them are fairly basic. It's flu season now. We would probably like to know about vaccination rates locally at the local level. and not just for flu, but for diseases. They track that in the U.S. In Canada, it's very hard to know at a local level who's been immunized, and so therefore which populations are most at risk for an outbreak. There were so many basic ones. We grouped them into either demographics or topics. There's huge parts of our housing market we don't know much about, and that's a topic that seems to interest almost everybody.
Yeah.
Such as unregulated mortgage lenders. In health, we don't know anything about wait times for mental health services, which means we don't know where needs are greatest, so where we can't target our policies effectively. We know a little bit now about murdered Indigenous women, and there's an inquiry about that. We still don't know how many are missing, because that's not tracked by ethnicity or Aboriginal status. I could go on. I could list all 28, but I did want to just add that we had a submission form attached to that online tool, and we weren't sure who would contribute. In the end, hundreds of people have contributed. So we're going to be going through those suggestions, but that suggests to me that the scale is much bigger than we had anticipated.
What are on, I mean, you mentioned not knowing the rates of vaccinations, for instance. What are some of the practical stories that you or Eric want to tell, or other reporters want to tell, but don't have the data to do it effectively?
The example that I think is maybe most timely is how far Canadians drive every year. There's a carbon tax now. It's going to be going up by $10 a ton of emissions every year. And for years, StatsCan or Transport Canada kept track of either through a driver diary kind of survey or by actually putting trackers in the engines of cars, how many total kilometers Canadians were driving. You know, this would be pretty useful data to show what kind of impact the carbon tax is having, making people change their behavior, which is the point. They discontinued that a few years ago. It was hard to get response rate for the diaries. It was expensive to do the electronic tracking. But this is something they have in the U.S. again. And we can return to that. The U.S. is kind of a mecca for open data in this strange way. You know, marriage and divorce rates. It's another one where...
We don't have marriage and divorce rates?
We did until 2008. There were budget cuts under Harper, and StatsCan decided that wasn't a priority anymore. So the frustrating thing about that one in particular is that, of course, all marriages and divorces are registered. So the numbers are there in different silos.
Right.
The Justice Department has a database of divorces, and every province registers every marriage. StatsCan used to go to the provinces and collect those numbers, go to the Justice database, collect the divorces, and publish it every year and say, this is the gross number of people who are married, gross number of people who are divorced. Here's how we calculate the rate. It has all kinds of practical implications for what kinds of housing you're going to build, how much daycare you're going to need, how many single seniors there are going to be in the long term. So some pretty weird basic ones that have real day-to-day implications.
There is, I will just add to that, there's real implications for us as reporters, but well beyond that, to put something out into the public and then let the public discuss it. So there's been a number of times when I've wanted to do an investigation, partly inspired by what I've seen in the U.S. For example, tracking lead levels and income levels to see which children may be most exposed or most at risk. We just can't do that. We can't tell those stories. We can't look at, for example, in the U.S., a large project about Black mothers who are dying in childbirth.
Right.
We don't know how many Indigenous women may be dying in childbirth. A lot of these can get into prevention. If you start airing these problems, you can start looking at how to fix them with precision. So not looking at a whole population, but looking at who is most at risk. And it often seems like, to me, the more marginalized you are, the less we have data about you or the less we can tell your story. Some examples of that would be people with disabilities. I've often wanted to write about unemployment rates, for example, with people with autism. Hard to get at that. We don't know much about the young and the old. We don't know much about people, the well-being of Indigenous communities. And we don't know much about even the demographics of who's poor in Canada. It's hard to get at.
So how much of this data is just non-existent, and how much of it is collected but not available to you?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's both. It's a two-prong problem, and you've identified the prongs. That's on race data. That's just not a category that's included in lots of surveys. We often just don't have that data. The marriage and divorce rates, the driving stuff, these are surveys that were discontinued. The data no longer exists. But there's a lot of data that is really hard to get at because of these research data centers. There are other reasons, but it's a really good embodiment of the data accessibility problem, which is kind of distinct, and Tavia can really talk about those.
Yeah, well, tell me what it's like then, Tavia, to try to get that data. What do you have to do and how successful are you typically?
Well, this is just based on my reporting, but certainly there are many steps. If you want to access some of these data sets and you're a researcher, there's at least a dozen steps to go through. And other countries also have steps to access some data, but it is particularly onerous. For example, you write a proposal and then you will wait weeks on end to hear back whether it's accepted or rejected. There's many steps, including a credit history check, fingerprinting. You have to swear an oath and you have to be sworn in as a StatsCan employee or a deemed employee.
Really? Like deputized?
Yes, literally.
So we're not arguing that we think that this data should be protected and there should be procedures. It shouldn't be a free-for-all. But there's also a lack of flexibility. So even once you go through those hoops, these data centers are only open for certain hours. If your research, you uncover something and you want to take a different course or you want to look up something else, you're going to have to go back to step one. So it's hard to be sort of either innovative or spontaneous and try to follow a train of thought if you want to follow up something. And a lot of this, there are some real consequences. I spoke with some researchers at UBC who have just given up on firm-level data, so data about businesses. They want to look at a very simple question of what is a good job? They're opting to use German data.
Really?
They can get it there. They can access German data more easily than they can Canadian data, which often you have to physically go into Statistics Canada's offices in Ottawa.
It seems so archaic. Not necessarily the security procedures, but the fact that you have to be physically present in an office between the hours of 9 and 4 or whatever to get your hands on numbers that are presumably kept electronically.
Yeah, these are not really space-age techniques for anonymizing this data and putting it online either. The outrageousness of the system doesn't really become clear until you talk to researchers about dealing with other countries. There's all kinds of relatively sensitive health population-level data in the U.S., for example, where they scrub it of names and identifying details, but they have procedures, and then they just put it on a website after it's been scrubbed and vetted and everything else. And it's not like the U.S. has no concerns about privacy or individual rights. They actually have a constitutional right to privacy. Mm-hmm. They get over these things because this is public data gathered at public expense about the public, and it's designed to make government work better.
So what happens when you start asking the Canadian government why this doesn't exist here? What kind of answers do you get?
That's been
that was a big dealing with the government inhale. Now you have to tell that story.
Well, part of what they say is, the problem's not so bad. We do have some data on this subject. That's one of their favorite responses, whether it's the government or a StatsCan, which is kind of an arms-like agency. We'll say, well, we don't know how far Canadians drive every year. Is that a concern for you? Are you thinking of fixing that? And they say, well, we do have some driving data. And it's kind of a hand-waving thing where they say, well, every year in the census, you get some sense of commuting times and so on. But I said, do we know how far Canadians drive every year? In some ways, I'm not sure some people in government understand the nature of the problem because they're not used to thinking about data in those terms, in terms of can it answer these pertinent questions that the public might have. They just think, okay, we've got some health data, we've got some transport data, we've got some energy data. Okay, we're doing all right. I think the other thing they maybe don't quite say, but that underlies some of the government's reticence to talk about this is that the Canadian public does have real concerns about privacy and data. I think politicians in Ottawa are more worried about facing political costs from having too much data, having it too widely accessible, too open, and freaking people out that way than they are concerned about the cost of not having enough data.
Tell me about how much data plays into storytelling, because I feel like a lot of people see the stories that reporters write about people, and then they see numbers. And for someone like you, Tavia, they're not separate.
They're intertwined.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I think the best stories combine the two. Often, when they don't, you can feel that they're missing something. But to me, data is the backbone. I've learned not to assume anything. Just because I observe it and anecdotally I hear about it certainly doesn't mean it's true. And I've learned not to make assumptions and that there's always going to be surprises. If you have a good data set, you should be looking out for things that you don't expect. So it's good to help curb your own biases and preconceptions. So some of our major projects have combined the two. We sometimes amass our own data, but then we go out and we really talk to people. And we say in journalism, we say real people, but we go out and talk to subjects about their own lived experiences. And that's kind of the heart and soul of it. So I think this story did manage to combine the two, and we'll be doing certainly more along that vein for sure.
We were concerned with this piece with not just making it about our own frustrations. Of course, journalists always want more information so we can tell more stories.
Right, but there's a whole class of people looking for this stuff.
There are several classes, and I think that's what we discovered. We knew from the get-go that researchers were frustrated about this, and we realized and our editors realized people don't necessarily just want to read about researchers banging their head against a wall. One of the things we kept coming across is the Auditor General. You read through its reports, people usually aren't looking for data gaps in the Auditor General reports, but there's almost always things that they flag where the government was trying to solve this problem. They had this program, spending lots of money on it, and they had no idea if it was working. So the government runs job training programs for Indigenous people. They don't follow up to find out whether the jobs those people get were part-time or full-time, or how long they stayed in their jobs.
That seems insane that you're spending money on the program.
It's a fiscal conservative issue too in a lot of ways. I mean, that program might be not working at all. You might want to ramp it up. You might want to cancel it altogether if it's a complete waste of money. Purpose of that program is to find meaningful, sustainable work for Indigenous people, and they have no idea if it's meaningful or sustainable. literally no idea. So it's I think wherever you sit in Canadian society, this is an issue. It's not just for people who love big government. It's not just for people who are telling stories.
I'll just add to that, too, several other groups. We did try to get a broad spectrum. We spoke to dozens and dozens of researchers right across Canada. But beyond that, we also spoke to other people and other people who use data in different ways. And two examples, one in the charitable sector, speaking to UNICEF. It seems like a basic thing, but they want to compile an index of child well-being in Canada. It's been very difficult because we don't have much on children at the national level. There's a lot of local or provincial studies, so they've had trouble finding comprehensive ways to add indicators into their well-being index. And the other one is parents of children with disabilities. The last comprehensive national big survey was 2006. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So certainly parents, one sort of poignant thing that one mother said is that when you don't track it, there's an invisibility to the issue and to some of the struggles that they're going through in terms of accessing either funding or supports. When people aren't measured, it does render them invisible. And in many cases, when they are measured or when there's something to reflect what they're going through, it is a sign of a more inclusive society.
How much of this was startling to you guys as you dug into it? Because as I read your reporting and talk to you, the image I keep getting is like someone stumbling around in the dark. And that's a scary thing to me when we're talking about data that should be used to plan our cities and healthcare and stuff like that. Were you shocked by the level you found?
I totally was. Atavia has been reporting on StatsCan and health and demographics and using data for longer than I have. And I had this kind of idea, and immediately Atavia and I started working together. And this is a problem that was, I think, more on her radar than mine, I would say. But I think we were both pretty shocked.
Yeah, I would say I've been at the Globe 13 years and I've never learned more from doing a story than this one. We all have our own silos, so I did know about the labor market. I knew about some economics data, but I didn't know much about health. And to me, health was very interesting and certainly something we'd like to pursue more because there's so much at stake. People's lives are at stake.
Both of you have kind of mentioned stats that are no longer kept after the Harper government. And my admittedly amateur understanding was that Trudeau and the Liberals ran on a promise of more transparency and more open numbers. Have we started to see that change? I mean, his term's almost up, so it'd be a little late, but have we started to see that change? And if not, what needs to change?
I think the Trudeau government's friendlier to data than the Harper government was. They reinstituted the mandatory long-form census, which was a big thing, but frankly, kind of a no-brainer. They have boosted StatsCan's budget a little bit. They have done some open government initiatives. We've been urging the government we've been asking the government if they will consider filling marriage and divorce rates. You could start doing that again tomorrow. And we put a bunch of these to the government, and they didn't answer, actually.
Not at all?
They didn't say yes or no. There's a budget coming up in March. We kind of think, maybe kind of hope that there'll be something in there, but this is getting a little political, but I I think they may be resting on their laurels a bit since reinstituting the census. They can point to that and say, we've done good work in this area. And
there are some gaps that are being filled. So I think the picture may look different in a year or two than it does now. However, there are some large structural issues, and there's been some small tepid steps taken, but nothing that's sort of overarching or sweeping that we see is going to dramatically change the picture. So we hope that this is going to be at least discussed in Ottawa and debated, because there may be some requirements to change the Statistics Act. There may be structural or legislative changes that are needed, and we will be writing further about this. But right now, we see the steps as being fairly tepid and sort of piecemeal rather than any kind of data revolution that is happening in other countries.
Globe and Mail reporters Eric Andrew G. and Tavia Grant. That was The Big Story. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca, at frequencypodcastnetwork.com, on social media at TheBigStoryFPN and at Frequency Pods. Please don't be afraid to drop us a line, drop us a tip, drop us a story request. We can always use them. And find us everywhere you get podcasts. Subscribe for free on any and all apps. You can leave us a rating. You can leave us a review. We would love to hear what you think. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.